Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as celebrating a home draw.
Andrew, welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5 o'clock. We're joined by the former Republic of Ireland striker Stephen Elliott and the Irish Independent football correspondent Dan McDonnell to talk about the beautiful game. Thanks to Paddy Power. Football and Off the Ball, thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. You can text us about the beautiful game, 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. Newcastle fans, I'm sure you're absolutely relieved. 2-0 up against West Ham, 2-2. And then Joe Willock scores the winner, 3-2. And now 9 points clear of Fulham. Look to be safe, Magpies fans, if you want to get in touch. We're streaming the conversation as well. You can listen to us on News Talk. You can also watch us on the social channels for Periscope and Twitter, at Off the Ball, YouTube, Facebook, and the OTB Sports app as well. If you haven't downloaded our great app, you can do so by searching OTB Sports in your app store if you haven't already. Good afternoon, lads. I hope you're well. We'll start with the breaking news this afternoon at Dundalk, Daniel, that Shane Keegan's quit his post as manager. The Lilywhites playing St. Pat's at 6 o'clock this evening in the League of Ireland Premier Division at Oriel Park. Filippo Giovagnoli doesn't have the coaching qualification, so he had this unusual arrangement where Shane Keegan was the nominal manager, but not a traditional manager where he'd be the ultimate caller of all the shots. I think it possibly was a position for Shane that became untenable.
Yeah, I think you'd be right there, John, to be honest. I know we would have spoken about this a couple of weeks ago, probably at the start of the season. And, like, you know, my sense always was, listen, if things started well, maybe this wouldn't be that much of a talking point. But obviously things haven't started very well at all. And it's been strange. Like, I mean, you have a situation elsewhere in the league where Stephen O'Donnell, for example, at St. Pat's, doesn't have the pro license, but he's very much out front. Like, he's doing all the press conferences, you know, he's the manager in all but name. And he can, you know, you can debate various ways of approaching it. But Dundalk seem to make a big solemn dance of going out of their way to say, no, like, Filippo isn't really the manager, yet you go to the games and it's obviously very clear who the main voice was. And I mean, the Bowes game last week in particular, it was sort of comical. I mean, as far as I understand, you know, I think Filippo was told he had to go into the stand. But like, from the stand, he was making substitutes down onto the pitch, and you could see that it seemed to be, I don't know, you got the sense that Shane Keegan on the touchline wasn't necessarily sure what was coming from behind him. I'm sure he'd have his own say on that in due course, but that was the way it looked. And yeah, I think it was an uncomfortable one for him. He was out doing press conferences before and after every game, you know, talking about sort of some, you know, questionable, I suppose, decisions, you could say, and putting, you know, putting out, you know, putting his sort of stamp on the answers. But, you know, kind of know that this, at best, like, this is someone who's been part of a consultation process of this, but deep down you sort of got the feeling that really, you know, you're explaining someone else's decisions. And it's just, there's just a lot going on off the pitch up there, really. And there seems to be, I mean, last weekend there was strong suggestions after the Bowes game that actually Filippo, that the two Italians were going to go. But it seems like the chairman is quite keen on them staying. And clearly Shane has decided to leave now. And yeah, I think it would be fair to say, I'm sure, listen, he has a media presence, so I'm sure in due course, like, you know, he'll be able to come and speak about it all. But I think it was a very uncomfortable arrangement for him, probably from the start. And It's no surprise to me, really, that this has happened, I have to say. Maybe the timing is a surprise, but in a way, nothing should surprise you with that club at the moment.
Norwich as well promoted back to the Premier League with Brentford and Swansea only drawing today, so congratulations to the Canaries. What's Jim McGilton's role there? Because he came into the club as well not too long ago, Daniel.
Yeah, so Jim McGilton's title is sporting director, you know, so it's, you know, like, you know, it's sporting director. It can be, you know, in some other places, it's director of football. You know, it's that sort of role that, in theory, I mean, Shane Keegan at the press conference, he did his weekly press conference the other day, said that, you know, McGilton would be the link between the dressing room and the ownership and the States. But again, all the indications are that the chairman in America remains, you know, very influential in terms of decisions that are made. And I think the expectation was that Jim McGilton was being hired to make these decisions that effectively, you know, when it came to maybe hiring and firing and, you know, the management of the management team and stuff like that, that Jim McGilton say would probably be final. It does appear from all the soundings out that's probably not the case at the moment. And maybe in time there may be a change of management team completely, and maybe that will be Jim McGilton's appointment, and maybe that's how things begin to work. But I don't know. It's definitely not working out the way things had intended. And without going down a sort of a rabbit hole, because it's quite a dense story for people to get into, like, Jim McGilton went in there around the time where a lot of, like, off-the-field staff at the club have left. You know, people are sort of in sort of general management positions, you know, administration, office administration, stuff like that. So in theory, Jim McGilton was being brought in to, like, professionalise aspects of the club. But in practice, as far as I know, like, he was bogged down in, like, licensing and paperwork and you know, office admin and all this type of stuff that really at another club, like a sporting director, wouldn't be doing that. But of course, this was the mad thing about Shane Keegan being presented as the manager that time. I mean, Shane Keegan not on the training pitch for the first couple of weeks in pre-season. He was back in the office doing office stuff to fill the gaps for people that have left. For whatever reason, over the last year or so, a lot of people have decided or have left that club in a really, like, sort of consistent way. There's been a steady stream of people departing, which I think has a lot of people reasonably quite worried about where things are going there, because, like, it's almost surreal to be talking about it. Like, this is a club that has won, you know, 5 league titles since 2014, that's been in the Europa League group stages twice, you know, was, I suppose, the dominant power in the league and had the power, you know, the financial power, there's no doubt. Like, it is very wealthy people behind the club, has the financial power, absolutely no doubt, to really be a real dominant force. And I think a lot of clubs in the League of Ireland couldn't compete with them in a lot of ways, and probably can't believe, really, that they've imploded themselves without any real pressure from outside forcing it. And it just does appear, really, that they've ended up in a situation where, I suppose, the main voice of the club, and they will say, well, listen, they're putting money in, they're entitled to do what they want to do, etc. But they don't know football, and they've allowed something that was pretty strong and pretty impressive to disintegrate. And all, honestly, all these comings and goings, they just add up to a big long list of dramas that anyone who's around, like, you know, people that are around the sort of football in Ireland, they all know the stories that are going around. They're not surprised by this. I think externally, there's always a surprise when something happens. But this, all this stuff has been coming. It's been flagged for some time. And yeah, like, appointments like bringing in McGilton, for example, was viewed as, okay, maybe this might steady the ship a bit, but it hasn't changed the ultimate issue, which would be, you know, it's not functioning as a club. Sure, for example, I did a podcast during the week with Pat Fenlon, who would have been at Shelburne at the time of Ollie Byrne, who everyone knew Ollie Byrne in Irish football, an amazing character, a colourful character, you know, and would have got into sort of various scraps with authority and with the FBI and whatever. But Pat Fenlon was quite clear and said this never, whatever about that, he always knew the boundaries of the dressing room and you know, not to let any of those quirks sort of seep in to that environment. That's what's happened with Dundalk. And it's very hard to get that back when it happens.
You can only be one voice, Stephen Elliott. Simple as that.
Yeah, again, listen to Dan speaking there about the club. Like, from the outside, looking in at Dundalk, this season, it's an absolute mess, if I'm honest. Like, I think they picked up 1 point, and obviously the talk about who's managing the team and the whole setup, there must be more to it, I presume. I presume we'll hear it in due course of how it's come to this situation. But the fact, like, I know Filippo came in last year and he done okay in Europe as well. He got a bit of a run going, but I don't know, it's one of them where you're thinking the League of Ireland is a league where I think you need to know the league to be successful in it. And listen, hindsight's a lovely thing. You look at when Vinnie Peart was in there, I know he kind of went through a tough spell last season when they eventually got rid of him, but in hindsight, it would have been a good idea maybe to keep him in there and let him turn things around himself, because he probably would have known better than anybody what was needed. And again, we're talking about ifs and buts here, but again, this season, to pick up 1 point, and I've watched some of the games this year on the League of Ireland watch, and it's like watching a different club altogether. And Yeah, I'm sure the other teams in the league are happy because it kind of creates a little bit more of an open race for accolades this season. But no, from an outside point of view, looking in, Dundalk were a powerhouse, and all of a sudden now they're kind of, even Cork City being in the first division, like, who would have thought that a few years ago that Cork City would have been in the first division and Dundalk sitting on 1 point after four games. It just shows you how football can change and swing so quickly.
I think the fear, and like, you know, I've had some sort of correspondence with people around this. Like, I think by all accounts, at the end of, say, Vinnie Parrott's time, like, I don't think the morale and everything was very good around the place, because I think it had been worn down by some of the interference which had started. You know, I think it got to the stage where they probably did need the change at that time, right? And they got a short-term boost out of it, by all accounts, because they had the new management team come in who had the full support of the owners, which was grand until they started to get bad results. And then all of a sudden they've become prey. So you're almost getting to the stage where you're thinking, like, is any management team ever really going to be able to be successful in that environment that's there? Because I think at the time when the change was made last year, I would have been speaking to a lot of players and people around. They said, no, listen, the mood was really bad and they probably needed some kind of change, right? But in hindsight, you look at it and think, can any management team succeed when they have something hanging over them that has the potential to be to cause a degree of instability? And that's the problem. And look, maybe the players don't always see the pressure that the managers maybe are under, you know, because they're dealing with it all the time, and maybe then they'd lost their relationship with that management team because, you know, like, there was layers to it. And I think that's the fear for everyone there, that there maybe isn't a manager there that can fix it.
Well, I think that's the issue. Looking at the performances, I think it is affecting the team, the whole mess.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Because they, watching them play, like, Dundalk, especially that season when I played in the league and when they were successful, you played against them, they were sharp, they were stronger than everybody else, they knew exactly what they were about. You're watching them now, and they do look a little bit kind of unsure of what formation-wise where they need to be. They lack that little bit of sharpness compared to some of the teams that you probably wouldn't say probably even train as much as them. And that all stems from, like, the mess that's happening above. And for that news to come out today, right before a game, it's just, again, it just adds to the kind of the craziness, because it's a big game today. This evening for them, like, they need to start picking up results, because you still look at the squad of players they have, kind of player for player, you'd still say they're one of the strongest squads on paper. So again, the players need to find a way, although they're a little bit unsure who's running things. As a player, you need to find a way sometimes amongst yourselves to get results, because I'm sure they'll have pride as well. They'll want to win some games, because you don't want to be losing every week, because it becomes very difficult then to turn that around.
Yeah, I think it's like one thing. Sorry, John. I think it's one, like, I mean, this is just to put it in perspective for people. I mean, this is probably, like, the spending on that Dundalk squad is up there with the spending on any squad in League of Ireland history. You know, it's well up there. There was a lot of in the mid 2000s there would have been some pretty high wage bills and you know, amounts of money sent out. But my understanding of recent years, now, in fairness, some of the payments they would have made would have been bonuses for, like, Europa League, you know, in fairness, you know, they got £3 million, you know, for getting into the Europa League only a couple of months ago. And to be fair, I have no problem with, you know, players who contribute to that, you know, getting substantial bonuses and stuff for it, like, you know, but it does appear that, like, you know, they have paid a lot of money at that club. And as a result, I think, you know, there's players on particularly good contracts. They have a player arriving in the next couple of days. He's in quarantine at the moment. He's in hotel quarantine. He's not in hotel quarantine. Sorry, he's just in the quarantine. This guy, his name is Wilfred Sahibo, who a couple of years ago was on the MLS team of the season. Like, he's played with Valencia. And again, apparently he's coming in on proper money for League of Ireland standards. You know, really, really good money. And it's not just a case that, like, they're back. You know, it's a team that's 1 point from four having a bad start to the season. Like, They're miles behind teams that probably have a wage bill that's like a third or a quarter of their size. Like, you know, it's to talk about underperformance. It's staggering. And to be fair, like, I think everyone acknowledges that it's probably been, you know, it's been Filippo's team in terms of decisions that have been made. Some of the tactical stuff and some of the decisions in recent weeks has been very bizarre. You know, like, really, really bizarre. And hence there's scrutiny coming on them, understandably so. But clearly there's a whole power struggle behind the scenes that probably is complicating things for everyone too. And I think to be honest, from Shane's perspective, I think he was probably a front man for it. But I'd say it's difficult to try and beat that if you're not necessarily actually really, you're not really making any of the, you know, the big decisions yourself. Like, there was a meeting,
okay,
I think last Sunday, in the club, you know, I think it was between like the Filippo and Giuseppe, the two Italians, and the players, you know, like that. There's all these little factions and stuff which aren't conducive. But yeah, listen, unfortunately, I fear that, you know, this one is going to rumble on.
Do they need to get another front man though? Is that not the problem with the no license?
Well, yeah, like I don't know what the, I'm not at the game this evening, so I'm not, you know, I'm not there, I suppose, figuring out what they need to do. There is a 60-day dispensation that can be there to operate without it, but there's a lot of I can't imagine, but I don't like to say something without having looked it up. And I'm not sure if Filippo can become that 60-day person again. But they do have Jim Magilton there, who's managed at a very high level and, you know, has a pro license and is very well qualified. But he was emphatic a couple of weeks ago. He actually, at the press conference, I asked, would we see you involved? And he said at the time, there's more chance of me being on the bench this season than him. Now, I'm not there tonight, so if Jim pops up, you know, already in the short space of time, that prediction hasn't lived up. Like, they might have to do that, or they may have to, as you sort of allude to there, John, you know, find someone else. But I think when there's pressure on, like, if they got a bad result tonight, like, for example, or in the next couple of games, that will fall on the Italians, I think, and then it might just be a case that a whole new management team would come in if the chairman permits it.
A big game earlier on, Newcastle 3, West Ham 2. Joe Willock, 3 goals in 9 games, Stephen, for Newcastle. I think they're safe. They're 9 points clear of Fulham. I think Fulham's challenge probably Petr Čech. And then West Ham, they could be leapfrogged now by Liverpool, by Chelsea. It's just a result that didn't go their way. I've looked at their last 4 games. They've conceded 10 goals in the Premier League. It could, if it'd gone the other way, it could have been, you know, seismic in different reasons.
Yeah, I think Newcastle have found a bit of form right at the kind of the perfect time, picking up a few results lately. And obviously Joe Willock again scoring the goal. He's got a couple of important goals and a lone player. I wonder will there be luck or whether Arsenal will be willing to let him go permanently. But he could be a player that Newcastle, if they want to kind of push on to that next level. I know the supporters living up this way are desperate for them to kind of go out there and make some more kind of statement signings and kind of put to bed this kind of relegation battle seemingly every year. But now West Ham, that result today kind of opens up that fourth place, and obviously Spurs and Everton drawing last night doesn't really kind of help either of them, and you got Liverpool Monday night against Leeds. So it makes it's probably the most exciting thing about the Premier League at the moment, that the Champions League run in, because you're looking at the relegation zone, you'd be very surprised if the bottom three at the moment don't go down. And obviously with City looking like they're going to win the league, United and maybe Leicester, them kind of last two positions. You say Man United will get the second spot, then them last two positions, third and fourth place, are probably the most exciting part of the Premier League. But at least it's something to kind of keep you interested in, I suppose, John.
Yeah, Harry Kane was brilliant last night, but it was just about him, really. I know he went off with an ankle injury, Stephen. He might be okay for the League Cup. But apart from that, Spurs were poor, and it's quite sad to see where Jose's got to now. Using distractions, around with Paul Pogba publicly, it's a bit messy there.
Yeah, it's strange. But again, we've seen this with Jose Mourinho before. We've seen at United a little bit towards the end of his kind of tenure there. He kind of gets into these little kind of silly little kind of debates with people where you probably look at him and think you don't really need to get involved with that, with the Pogba thing. But yeah, Spurs, you've always got that League Cup final probably in the back of your head thinking, can you beat Man City again? And kind of there's a paper over a few of the cracks. But Harry Kane, I think we've spoken about Harry Kane so often. He's finishing last night was out of this world, and I think it just enhances his value like in the market. And I don't know, I'm sure there'll be plenty of clubs after him in this year, and he'll have a big decision to make himself, whether he wants to kind of move away from Spurs, where he obviously loves the club, he's part of the club, Spurs supporter. But again, I presume when you're at that level of player, you want to add kind of titles and trophies to your armour. And I don't know whether he's going to achieve that at Spurs. I think he missed the best opportunity, I think, was a couple of years ago with Poch when he got to the Champions League final against Liverpool. That was probably when they were at their best, and you think they've just gone a little bit downhill at the moment. But from a personal point of view, Kane, I'd be, the only thing that would keep him there is his love for the club, but I just think he's at that stage now where I think he needs to move on. I heard Berbatov come out, Dimitar Berbatov, talk about when he was in a similar situation at Spurs a few years back when he went on to Man United to try and win things. And it's a little bit like that. Obviously, Harry Kane, I'd probably put him up as a higher bracket than Berbatov as a forward. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the summer. There's obviously Kane, there's talk of Kane moving, Mbappe and Haaland. There's a few pretty decent strikers that could be on the move.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Champions League after the break and Harry Kane possibly going to one of the Manchester clubs. I think surely that as well. PSG has been linked to PSG as well with Pochettino, but I think that Premier League goal scoring record is something that he has in his mind. Let's get an update before the break from the Ireland-France game in the Women's Six Nations in association with Guinness. Alison Miller, what's going on?
Hi, it's 43-8 here in France. Just before halftime, Safi Diaye got over the try line, as did Cyril Bane. Just in the second half, then we had another try from Caroline Dujard. So it's currently standing 43-8. Amy Murphy-Crowe has taken to the field. So we're looking forward to seeing if she can get the ball to her.
Okay, a bit of a disappointing result, but hopefully something to build on for the Irish team, because they will have another game in the Women's Six Nations. We're going to take a break and we'll talk about the amazing Champions League football that we saw during the week with Stephen Elliott and Dan McDonald. Don't go away.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
Andrew, welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5. We're joined by the former Republic of Ireland striker Stephen Elliott and the football correspondent of the Irish Independent, Dan McDonald, to talk about the beautiful game. Our coverage thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. You can text us 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. Newcastle 3, West Ham 2 earlier in the Premier League, so huge boost for Newcastle. Surely they're going to survive now with West Ham's hopes of Champions League football may be suffering a blow that Chelsea and Liverpool can exploit. And Norwich promoted to the Premier League at the first attempt because Brentford and Swansea failed to win. Will we see Andrew Mobamedele in the Premier League next season? We might be talking about him a bit later on. Just a text in here on 53106. Guys, come on, why are you making Dundalk the horror story? The question is, why the top team in Ireland at the time employ a coach with no pro licence? He's that good, is he? He doesn't need one, says Johnny in Ashburn. Well, I think he's trying to get one. And Shamrock Rovers are the champions. We had amazing Champions League football during the week. It was a joy to watch Paris Saint-Germain. And we had Manchester City. Absolutely brilliant stuff. I'm just going to get to Miguel Delaney, who was speaking to Nathan Murphy about it and just lauding how great this is.
Nothing better in world football than the knockout stages of the Champions League.
Oh, I'd say it's better than ever. And I don't think it's an exaggeration at this point to say it's the highest level of football we've ever seen. And that's because of what club football has become, which is basically, I mean, there are a lot of inherent problems for this and a lot for the game to consider. But, you know, a group of 8-9 clubs or so have accumulated more resources and therefore more talent, both in terms of players and coaches, than has ever been seen in football. So naturally that brings, you know, it's a collection of brilliance together. Hence, we're seeing football reaching a higher level than ever before. But I suppose this game was actually a little bit of a throwback because it was so tense and so it was low scoring in the right way, in that it didn't feel a negative game. Both were going for it, but the goals didn't come, which meant that it always had that feel where the next moment was going to be absolutely decisive, in a way that used to be the case in kind of classic European ties of the 90s, which probably were a bit more defensive because the football in the 90s was more cautious. Tactics weren't as open. You know, we didn't see the same level of pressing that we do now. But yeah, it was an absolutely brilliant tie.
Daniel, the UAE versus Qatar, PSG against Manchester City in the Champions League semi-final. Does the sports washing bother you, or are you just absolutely thrilled now to be watching De Bruyne, Neymar and Mbappe?
Listen, I think it has to bother you, John. Like, I mean, I think it's a pact we all sign into to some degree, like that, you know, listen, I agree with everything Miguel said there. Like, it's such a great level of football, and we want to watch the best footballers play each other. So you enjoy it. But of course, like, I mean, you have to be honest, and you know, you can't sort of suspend your critical faculties and just go, but listen, that's the way of the world. Like, it is, obviously, you know, It's there's sickening aspects to it, and some people would say, well, then can you enjoy it then? And I understand that point. And I think it's maybe a fair, you know, if someone has a strong view on that and says you can't enjoy it because of that, I think I have to respect someone's view on it and not take any issue with it. I think it's a very fair opinion for someone to hold. But, you know, we are in this sort of weird lockdown mode where it is like, you know, it's great entertainment to watch the best play against the best. And maybe that makes us all bad people in a way for enjoying it. But like the thing about it is, I mean, and what bothers me, and I've gone on about this before, so I don't want to go on a tangent, but like the Champions League works so well as it is because you have that great sense of anticipation around, you know, the knockouts that's built by the less is more aspect of the big clashes. And we are seeing these Champions League changes being brought in going forward that I think is going to have a negative impact. You can have too much of a good thing in such a way that it'll dilute the impact of, you know, the fact that we're really looking forward to like PSG now, City, you know, in a real game of consequence. But if we had five of them a year, I don't know. I appreciate you're still going to have a knockout format in the Swiss version of the competition, but it's still not the same. And obviously, greed is in danger of ruining this completely. But listen, greed has brought us a long way down this road already, and you know, financial fair play probably solidified the positions of certain clubs and made it harder for people to get into it. And listen, there's layers to it. But I'm not just sort of blindly, you know, getting on with it. But there is certainly no romance in it. This is a romance-free zone. There is no romance in the winning of the Champions League now. But there is quality. Like, there's excellence. You know, there's the elite level of you know, the most popular sport in the world, you know. And as Miguel rightly says, like, you know, you would have great teams in the sort of 70s, 80s, great European Cup teams, but the players were all drawn broadly from the region that team hailed from, whereas now there's such a concentration of resources that you can have, you know, all the best players in the world in a small number of clubs. But when they clash, when they really clash, it makes for some good stuff. And I know, like, you know, Sleeves has his theories about who might win it, and there's certainly, you know, the PSG Bayern game, and I think even the Dortmund City game when City were behind, you know, seeing really good teams up against the ropes, it's just brilliant to watch them when they're really under severe, this is pressure, and how they respond. I mean, that is the highest level of sport.
Yeah, Nottingham Forest would not be winning back-to-back European Cups now. We can safely say, even how great Brian Clough was. City were beating themselves, I feel, in the last few years in this competition, Stephen, but they got over this. They got over the yellow wall, as Dan was saying there, that 2-1 win over Dortmund. Can they now take PSG and Mbappe and Neymar?
Yeah, it's a melt-watering tie, isn't it? I think I was speaking to Dan off air about PSG. I enjoy watching them so much. Even the two games against Bayern Munich, they were kind of two unbelievable games to watch, but kind of different at the same time. Like, obviously 3-2 and then 1-0, and PSG kind of holding on at towards the end when Bayern were giving it a little bit of a go. But now it's going to be, I'm really looking forward to the game. I just think you look at Man City there, even when they went behind the other night, I think they've learned a little bit from previous years. If you watch the good teams, the thing I like about this is watching the Champions League, the kind of later rounds, I love watching them. It's like kind of, you always kind of make sure that you've got that kind of little slot in your life free on a Tuesday and a Wednesday night, so you can kind of watch.
For a bit of a man, Stephen.
Yeah, you're just watching them. It's the quality, and the teams don't panic. That's what I like about it. Like, they go behind, and the teams at this level know that they have the quality, no matter who they're up against, that they don't need to panic because they just keep doing what they need to do, and they know the quality on the pitch will create chances for them. And because the best forwards are playing, the best attacking players are playing, you tend to see a lot of goals. I know, obviously, we didn't see loads in the Bayern-PSG game, but there could have been a few more. And it just makes for entertaining football, end-to-end, open football. Like, there's nobody sitting back and parking the bus, so to speak, with these teams. And everybody just kind of, the managers trust the players to go out there and kind of, and I'll put it this way, there were supporters at the ground. You're going away from them games absolutely entertained to more than any other game, I think, for the season. So even Anfield on it, I know obviously Liverpool went out to Madrid and it was a little bit of a kind of, Madrid kind of done a job on them, but I think it's just the atmosphere, the whole kind of feeling of a Champions League quarterfinal, semi-final, it just makes it very watchable. And regarding the City-PSG game, I don't know, I just think, I'd be very wary of PSG if it was Man City. Listen, you're going back to Pep v Poch again, and obviously Poch has won up on him, doesn't he, in a Champions League semi-final from that game a few years back when he was manager of Spurs. So that all these things come into kind of managers' minds, I would presume. And yeah, it's gonna be great. And listen, I hope everybody's fit for the game. All the big stars are playing and they're all on the pitch, because it's one of them where you got Kevin De Bruyne, Mbappe, Neymar, you got Gundogan, Sterling, whoever plays up front for City. These are like top quality players, and I'm expecting a lot of goals, but I just have a sneaky feeling that City might come up short again. I don't know what it is. I just have this funny feeling in me go.
I think it was the PSG were so good, and yes, the mad thing was like that. Remember that chance late on the other night where Neymar hits the post and he could have passed, mm-hmm. and you're just thinking if they go up and score, we'd be having a discussion here about here we go again, the biggest PSG bottle job. We'd be analysing the body language between Neymar and Mbappe and all this.
I think it was such good defending though. I think he wanted to pass it to him, but the defender like kind of just got himself in such a good position, and you could see Mbappe was looking at him as if to say, like, do you know what I mean? He didn't have a pop or him, but he gave him the kind of look. But this is a 20 or 21 year old kid as well. Shows you how good he are. Like I think Mbappe is unplayable, if I'm honest. When I'm watching PSG, obviously they've got other good stars, but I don't know about you. When I'm watching, I'm like, when PSG pick up the ball, knowing they're kind of on the counter attack, and like when they've been defending, they go on that transition to attack, I'm looking for him on the pitch. Where is he giving the ball? I want them to be on the ball because he entertains me. Do you know, it's like the last goal he got in the first leg against Bayern, it was a prime example of Mbappe at his best, picking up the ball and just driving. And when he reminds me a little bit, I don't know whether he's as good as him at the moment, but Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo,
yes.
Like he's phenomenal. That. Yeah.
Yeah, he has that effect on me when I'm watching. Because I remember watching Ronaldo as a kid playing, and it was like I was watching him. I was mesmerised by him. Thinking it was like a cheat code to football. I think, give him the ball, nobody's going to get it off. He's just going to run by people and score. And I have that, like, watching Mbappe, I think he has a little bit of that about him. And he's just unplayable at times. And he's a joy to watch.
I think the thing about, like, you know, when he stands the defender one on one, like, you know, the goal in the first leg, you just know what's going to happen. There was that sense where the young Ronaldo that you knew what was going to happen. Like when he got the ball, you knew 10 seconds later what the outcome was going to be. Like there was this sense of this is what's going to happen. And there is that. But the one thing I'd say about PSG, like at the same time, for all that they have that spectacular side to them, like if Lewandowski had been fit for that tie, you kind of wonder would it have been a different outcome, particularly the first game, you know, the amount of sort of chances that Bayern had. If they'd had Lewandowski around the place, you just wonder. But anyway, that wasn't the point I was going to make. I'm just going to say that, I mean, the highest compliment you can pay to these lads is that these closed doors games, we know that they're still, it's not the real thing without the crowds. Yet in those two PSG Bayern games, I don't know about you, but I wasn't feeling there's no crowd there in the stadium. You're actually so absorbed by it. Whereas, for example, earlier, I caught the second half of Newcastle West Ham. Okay, it was 3-2 and there was a comeback and all of that. But actually, like, the game was a bit all over the place. You know, it was a bit, it was just a bit crap in a way. Like, you know, and it was entertaining, but it was very much like little mistakes and stuff that you can tell, well, they're so used to without crowds at this stage. You know, it's just there's a different pressure and atmosphere, and it's all a bit sort of lethargic in a way, even if it is high scoring. But those games, those PSG Bayern games, they were like you were absorbed, locked into it, and you weren't feeling, oh, there's no fans there.
You're looking at the clock and you're thinking 89 minutes. You think, nah, you don't want it to end. Like,
yeah,
of course, like, especially you're watching and you're thinking you want to watch. Like, you want to watch it all night because they don't look like they get tired either. They're just all the players, the prime, fine-tuned athletes, and they just keep going right till the end. And it's, again, I watched Sunderland versus Blackpool today, talking about games, and it's like it's like you're watching a different sport when you watch kind of the elite. These lads are like on another planet compared to most football games we watch, let's be honest.
Yeah. 5-3-1-6. I think the quality is gone back from 10 years ago. Barca versus Real, the semi-final, was the apex of football quality for me. Isn't there a bit of romance in saying that Pep getting back to the Champions League final, if he does, has one of our textures, shaping a team, coming back to a final, not gone with the wind, you know, but romance all the same, says Kieran in Dublin, sticking
with it. It's more of a it's more of a cheap romantic movie you get on Netflix or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not ultimate romance.
I'm more into the I don't know, the crime stuff, Dan.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just saying it's a rom-com maybe.
It's not
as much charm. But I know the point. Like, there's a personal triumph for Pep. You know, if he does it, there's no doubt. Like, it's the question he's faced. But I mean, it is with the Man City sort of super millions, you know.
Wouldn't it be great though if Aguero came on in the final and scored a winner or something over his last
Drogba style?
That would probably make the cinema, wouldn't it, Dan?
That possibly would. Yeah, that, you know, he's been there long enough to have the. Yeah, it's not someone just bought it. And then, like, in fairness, they have the Foden angle as well, which I think is a good story for City. That, like, that for all that they, you know, they bought in obviously all the talent that they have, that they do have like one of their own that is actually definitely up to it, you know. And it's not like even in the early days of Foden, there's that little niggling sense of, well, listen, they really want their local boy done good to be, they need this, you know, they want him. So they're giving him opportunities, but you kind of wonder, is it going to be one of those where, well, eventually he'll go elsewhere or he'll just fall that short? But no, he's the real deal, Foden. Like, and he sort of stepped up at big moments. And it's interesting, you're talking about City, how they didn't panic. I actually thought the other night, the sort of 5 minutes or so before half time, I thought they were getting a little bit, there was the odd sort of jittery sign. But then they obviously just regrouped at half time. And I mean, that's obviously management and players and everything. And they realised, no, listen, we can go and do this. And they're like the little moments. But Foden, I don't know what you think of him, Stephen. Like, he's actually the real deal now in terms of his impact.
Yeah, and I think Pep has done great with him. Like, no, when he first broke onto the scene a couple of years ago where he's only a kid, and he's still a kid now, but he was very slight and you're wondering, is he strong enough? But I think he's filled out a little bit. And I think Pep would be seeing him every day in training. Like, there was talk of him going out on loan, like, and maybe doing a stint elsewhere and kind of getting that experience under his belt, like other players have done in the past. But Pep was insisting, no, we'll keep him here and we'll buy the time for him. And obviously with David Silva gone now, he seems to be getting a little bit more. But he's actually in there now, and he's creating big moments week in, week out. And he's kind of becoming a go-to player for City, a little bit more so than even Sterling, who's not getting really much of a look in the team these days. But I think Foden, yeah, he's a special talent. And again, never mind City, I think England have some really good young players coming through now. Even Jude Bellingham, who scored for Dortmund there. Everybody was talking about when he retired his jersey, thinking, retiring his jersey at 17. And it's one of them where I still think it was a bit crazy. But you're watching him do stuff like this in the kind of later rounds against the kind of superstars of world football. And you think, you know what, this kid may be just a bit special as well. But now Foden, immense talent. And I've no doubt he'll go on and achieve a lot in his career. And I presume it's going to be a top clubs that are kind of challenging at the top end of European football, as well as kind of Premier Leagues. And who's to know? He has that style of play that if Pep ever did kind of move on from Man City and went to another club, you wouldn't be surprised to see him kind of look to Foden, because I think he could play in the continent as well. With his style, he's that good.
What about Raheem Sterling? It seems that he's fallen out of favour with Pep, and it might be hard for him to get back in because Pep doesn't strike me as a sentimental figure, especially with a quadruple on the line.
It's a surprising one, all right. I think Pep has maybe been talking about this in the last 24 hours, still pointing out that he's had quite a few minutes this season. Like, he's still up there in the charts. But I think I was on during the week with Joe, and he mentioned they had Sam Lee on, a Man City journalist, who said that there'd been
that,
a row.
Yeah,
there'd been a row with Sterling and Pep. Not a massive one, but say a disagreement back in the autumn, I believe. And that maybe there's a sort of a legacy of that hanging over. But I also don't think, like, his basic form has probably been that good. And it's the testament to City that, like, you know, they can have maybe a player like that having an under par season and it's not really noticed, because they got Mahrez, who's like really, like, Mahrez is a big name for them as well too now, you know, who wasn't always that when he was there. And then, yeah, you can list them all off, De Bruyne, etc. You know, they can get through it.
Sterling, although he's not quite hit the heights he has done in recent, I watch him like kind of his all-round game. It's not terrible. He's maybe missing a few. He's still like a massive threat on the pitch when he plays for City. Like, most things he does is good, but I think it's because there's a standard that he's set over the last couple of years. You're kind of looking at him and you're kind of analyse them, because you know Man City, like you mentioned there, have other players that are sitting on the bench that will come in and do just as good a job. So if you're not quite at that unbelievable elite level, then there's a chance is that somebody else is going to come in and going to be at that level. Like they don't carry, you can't carry passengers. Like Man City have went on this run in the league, and it's no coincidence that every player is playing. Like, I know they slipped up against Leeds there last week, which was a one-off, but the form Man City have been in this year has been unbelievable. And I know they've got a big cup game this afternoon against Chelsea, which kind of, I think they win that game, you're talking about winning the quadruple, like, which has never been done before. And this is something that Pep Guardiola, I'm sure, would love to kind of eventually, when he does leave English football, to say, yeah, I've done something that nobody else has done, you know. And you wouldn't put it past them. I think the Champions League is always going to be the toughest one to win, but with the squad of players Man City has, they're definitely good enough to do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect to see Bellingham and Haaland wearing Dortmund jerseys for too long, lads.
Yeah, well, Bellingham might stay a while, you would have thought, but I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, the Haaland one seems inevitable, doesn't it? A million a week they're talking about. But what is he hasn't scored in 7 games? Look, it's obviously a crisis situation for him here. But Bellingham obviously eventually won't, but you would think a couple of seasons there is probably would be the right step for his development, I would have thought.
We'll probably talk about Liverpool after 4, because Jurgen Klopp's got a bit of surgery, I think, to do on their squad, and obviously the League of Ireland and maybe crowds coming back. But just on that other pairing, Chelsea and Real Madrid, does Zidane get the credit he deserves? It's a strange one, Zidane, because we talk about Guardiola's brilliance as a manager in the 2 Champions Leagues he won with Barcelona and the best probably football we've seen since Brazil in 1970. Zidane has won 3 Champions Leagues in a row. He's going for another one. They're in the hunt for La Liga again. Stephen and Dan. Stephen, what is the deal with Zidane as a manager? Because it just seems to be all very much low key, and maybe his career as a player is overshadowing his career as a manager still.
Yeah, well, I think just the mere mention is in his Zidane, it's like royalty of football, and his kind of playing career speaks for itself. I think he's one of 3 players to score in 2 World Cup finals. He's won the World Cup, won the Euros, won every kind of domestic trophy. At Madrid, at Juventus, European Cups, he's won everything. And then so because he was such a superstar as a player, you kind of he goes into management. And I think a lot of people probably look at him and think, you know what, I don't know why, but people probably look and think, you know what, he went in as Real Madrid's kind of was a B team manager or the kind of, and then he kind of given the job, and people might say he didn't have to work to kind of earn that job. But I just think with the pedigree of the man himself and the kind of the charisma that he holds, I think he's definitely up there. He's one of the best managers around. There's no shadow of a doubt. You're managing players as well. Like we're talking about elite players. When he won 3 Champions Leagues with Real Madrid, you're managing players like Ronaldo, those players that have massive egos. You can't. It takes a big manager to win and be able to kind of get them clicking and get them walking. And again, he's gone back into Madrid now, and there's a likelihood they're going to win the La Liga this year, and they're still in with a great shout at the Champions League. And I think even setting up there against Liverpool the other night, he showed he's tactically astute as well. He knew what he needed to do, and he got his team and he set them up and made it quite difficult for Liverpool. Liverpool never really looked like scoring, and in saying that, Madrid always looked a threat as well because they have these quality players. And yeah, I think it all stems from the manager. I think he is a little bit kind of, I don't know, kind of underrated a little bit, but I think that will change. I think people are starting to realise and give him a little bit of credit for him. And I do think that the reason why he was underrated is because people just think maybe because he was such a superstar player, he kind of had it easy. He was handed this kind of really, really good squad of players anyway, so he didn't have to do much. But believe me, I think he's phenomenal. And I do think he could go to any top team in European football and be successful.
Daniel, what do you make of the Zidane conundrum, if there is one?
Yeah, no, I think Stephen summed it up well enough there. Like, maybe you wondered how he got into the job. Does that sort of, like, he didn't have that stage of being like this really talked about manager that's lit up, you know, that's brought some smaller club to some achievement or other, you know. And I get that, but no, listen, like, I mean, they are a club that's obsessed with the Champions League, like Madrid. They always have been. Like, if you go there, like they place way more stock on that than even even some of the domestic stuff. You know, it's really a Champions League obsessed club. And to be fair, like, he did have big game players that, you know, delivered at the business end when it got to the knockouts. Like, they always knew how to did it, knew how to do it. But I think this sort of second Madrid story is on the way to becoming a bit more impressive and will probably get him more respect, because there's the feeling he doesn't have that superstar quality in the dressing room that was there before, or those that remain are a bit older. You know, there was always a sense, well, listen, it's a Ronaldo factor that's maybe pulled him through at certain times, or even Bale had his year before he got big into the golf, you know. Whereas now it's almost a sense of, because they don't necessarily have the players that everyone was talking about, the manager's getting a bit of love. And that's just, you know, that's just the way that these things work sometimes.
We got to take a break. 5-3-1-0-6 for your text messages on OTB Football Saturday here. Just going to go through some of the scores. Dan McDonnell and Stephen Elliott will join us between 4 and 5 to talk about Liverpool, Arsenal and Man United's wins during the week in the Europa League, the League of Ireland, maybe getting some crowds back in there as well, and Chelsea, Manchester City previewing the FA Cup semi-final at 5:30. Newcastle 3, West Ham 2 earlier in the Premier League, Wolves against Sheffield United this evening, and then the Championship full times: Brentford 0, Millwall 0, Luton 1, Watford 0, Middlesbrough 1, QPR 2, Nottingham Forest 0, Huddersfield Town 2, Sheffield Wednesday 1, Bristol City 1, Stoke 0, Preston 0, Swansea 2, Wickham 2. So these results, with Swansea not being able to win and Brentford also failing to win, means that Norwich are promoted back to the Premier League. They take on Bournemouth at 8 o'clock this evening. This is OTB Football Saturday. You can text us 53106. Don't go away.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
Welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. You choose Ireland. We're joined by the former Republic of Ireland striker Stephen Elliott and the football correspondent of the Irish Independent, Dan McDonald, to talk about the beautiful game, football and off the ball, of course, thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. You can text us 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. You can watch us on the social channels for Off the Ball on Periscope, Twitter, at Off the Ball, YouTube, Facebook, and on the new OTB Sports app for iOS and Android. Search OTB Sports in your app store now. So as well as listening on News Talk, you can watch us on these streams. And Norwich promoted back to the Premier League today, and Newcastle beating West Ham by 3-2. Stephen Elliott and Dan McDonnell. Chelsea, we spoke about PSG and Manchester City and Real before the break. Stephen, would you give Chelsea a chance against City today? Would you give them a chance against Real? Tuchel knows what he's doing, obviously. He's got them organised, and they're quietly going about their business.
Yeah, they've obviously got a chance. It's a kind of one-off cup tie. Well, obviously the Champions League's a two-legged one, but today's game is they've got a chance. I think if anybody can kind of stop and put a halt to Pep's kind of trophy kind of campaign, you probably would say Thomas Tuchel. He's an experienced manager, like you mentioned there. He's come in, he's got Chelsea really organised, and they're a bit of a threat as well, goal-wise. They've proven they can score goals. So no, I would suspect City will win the game, but you just don't know. They've always got a little bit of a chance. If you can kind of frustrate, stay in the game and don't let City concede, don't concede to City early doors, then the longer they stay in the game, then you'll always feel like they may get a chance of scoring a goal in the game. But I do think Man City, with the way they're playing, I know obviously I mentioned earlier on they slipped up a bit to Leeds last week, with the way they're playing and with the kind of trophies they have inside, they will want to win this, and they'll want to win it kind of comfortably as well today.
Leicester and Southampton tomorrow. This will not be a 9-0, I doubt, Stephen.
No, yeah, it's kind of a bonus game for both the teams. Obviously, looking at the league, kind of the league positions, you would say Leicester are going to go into that game as favourites, but Southampton, it's a cup semi-final. I presume the players are going to be well up for it, and they're going to give it their all to try and kind of stop Leicester's kind of attacking players kind of to get in behind them. But no, it's an interest. Anything can happen in the cup semi-final, and as I said, Leicester can have their off day. So if Southampton can kind of get the ball down and get Ings kind of get in behind the Leicester defence, the likelihood is he'll put chances away. So I wouldn't be overly confident that Leicester will definitely kind of win that one. I think that's a bit more open than the kind of Chelsea City game.
Yeah, for Brendan Rodgers, Dan, it could be a nearly season. They could be in the Champions League spots. They could win the FA Cup, or neither could happen.
Yeah, it's just they've had one or two results lately that make you wonder: is it happening again? You know, it's sort of slipping away from them again. As much as they've time on their side, and I mean, I'd say, to be honest, like, you know, the Champions League is obviously going to be way up the charts above the FA Cup. I wish that wasn't the case, you know, but I think obviously, you know, in terms of where the club is trying to go, you know, the Champions League is more important. But he'd still be attracted by the opportunity, of course, of, like, you know, getting to a final and all that goes with it. But I sort of agree with Stephen. Like, they're sort of hard to call. Like, on their day, Leicester, they can be very good. And actually, in a weird way, like, you wouldn't discount them if they got through from, like, doing something in the final, because they on a given day they can execute a plan and be very sort of efficient in how they do it. But they can also throw one in a bit, and that would obviously be the fear that they would have going into this game tomorrow. But yeah, it's getting that. I mean, you see West Ham today, and yeah, okay, Leicester are better and have higher expectations than West Ham, but it is the time of the season sometimes where some of the more surprise packages they lose some sort of momentum as the run-in comes into sight. But yeah, no, listen, Brendan would love the chance, I'm sure, to beat it. I think in a way they probably all like the idea. I mean, Mourinho first and foremost, of, like, being the one to stop the quadruple, you know, in some shape or form. They'll all fancy a crack at doing that.
Yeah, I remember Liverpool had a chance with the treble in 1977 and Man United stopped them. We got a full-time in the rugby in the Women's Six Nations in association with Guinness. Ireland, unfortunately, they've lost to France. What's happened? Tell us how it all unfolded, Alison Miller.
Yeah, 56-15 point difference here. So France took too dominant in the end for Ireland. Ireland did manage to get a second try on the 74th minute from Emma Hooven. Shout out to the Leash woman, I have to put that in there. So, in all, it was 7-2, but I think, that, you know, Ireland will be obviously disappointed with the result, but there were some good performances from some Irish players. I thought Emer Constantine had a very good game. She made a lot of last-man tackles, stopped some certain tries. You know, Emily Murphy-Crowe got her first cap. I thought Stacey Flood made a really big impact when she came on. But ultimately, it was a disappointment for the Irish girls. We obviously saw some more tries from the French. There was a 55th-minute try from Romain Menage. Very strong, very difficult player to try and deal with. Another try from the winger, Cyril Banet. So it's ended up here, yeah, 56-15.
Okay, disappointing result, Alison. Thanks so much for keeping us up to date this afternoon in Donnybrook at Energia Park, where Ireland have lost to France in the Women's Six Nations. If you're Jurgen Klopp in the summer, what are you thinking at the moment, Stephen? Because a few changes will have to be made at Liverpool, whether they qualify for the Champions League or not.
Yeah, well, straight away, you're kind of... I think if you're Jurgen Klopp, you're looking forward till the end of the season. I know you would like to kind of get that Champions League qualification kind of done and dusted, but I don't know. I think it's been a strange season for Liverpool. You can point to all the injuries they've had at the one time hasn't helped their cause, but I don't think you can use it as a total excuse. I just think maybe it all caught up with them. The past kind of 2-3 seasons, they've been kind of, the form they've been in, the points accumulation in the league, they were hardly losing a game ever. And then to go from that kind of form to what we've seen this year, losing, was it seven games on the bounce at Anfield, wherever it was, it's I think he's just wanting the season to end, and he's going to probably have to look at his squad, I think, and evaluate where it is. There's a few players there that you're probably looking at and thinking, are they going to take Liverpool back to the level where they have been over the last couple of years? I see even recent games. Now, no disrespect to the likes of Shaqiri, Oxlade-Chamberlain, who've been coming on, good players in their own right, but are they the type of players that, are they Liverpool players where Liverpool want to be now at the moment, going up to that kind of the challenge? Your Man City, Man United, who've improved now, Chelsea, under Tuchel, are going to be stronger next year. The European kind of teams as well in Europe, if they are in the Champions League, they want to be competing with them. So I think he has to make the signings, whether the owners of the club are going to come forward with the funds needed to get the signings that he requires is another question. But without a doubt, he needs a little bit more kind of security in the background, a little bit more strength and depth. I think the squad's been found out a little bit this year. As I said, I know the injuries have been really kind of, even that time when he did kind of bring in Jota, that time when Mino went off the boil, Jota picks up an injury, and it was one of them seasons where everything that went wrong for Liverpool, that could go wrong for Liverpool, seemed to go wrong. And the fact that they still could come over now with a Champions League spot, well, they probably take that as a bonus. Because I think I remember Jurgen Klopp even mentioning there a few weeks ago, saying if they didn't qualify for Europe, then next year it'll be more of a dangerous animal with no European football to kind of distract them. But no, they need signings. They need top signings. Midfield, I think they need Thiago's come in with kind of a lot of history of being a top player in European football, and I think he was signed for the present. He's not one for the future. So the fact that he's come in and he hasn't really had a chance to play Thiago with his preferred midfield with the injuries is probably frustrated Klopp. But again, Thiago needs to do more next year. Again, having the break and the off season, obviously I know Thiago had the COVID, he picked up his injury in the first game against Everton. These things wouldn't have helped him, but I just think Klopp himself, he'd be looking forward to the end of the season, having that little break and then getting everybody back together and hopefully adding a bit more strength and depth to the squad. Centre-halves, he'll have Van Dijk back, which will be gigantic for them. I think his presence alone will give everybody a lift, and I think he probably needs another striker, another kind of world-class striker, because I think Bobby Firmino, as well as he has done for Liverpool over the last 5-6 years, I think you're watching him now even, and can he get back to the level that he was at when he was one of Liverpool's best players? I'm not sure. But again, that's why Klopp has played the big money, and I do think he knows what is required, and I think he's just looking forward to kind of being given the chance to do that in the summer.
Mane and Firmino, one Premier League goal each in 2021. They've lost 8 of 12 games in 2021, but they can still reach West Ham now after their loss today. So they're definitely not out of it in terms of qualifying for next season's competition. They play Leeds on Monday night. They've made £323 million, according to The Telegraph, in their 4 years of Champions League football the last 4 years. And I've got a text in here as well on 53106 about it. If I can get it up. What Liverpool need most of all is steady and experienced leadership on the field, like Gary McAllister brought under Houllier. Without Henderson, Van Dijk or Milner, they play like headless rookies when the going gets tough. That is from Paul in Wicklow. Klopp's going nowhere, Dan, so it's just a case of what changes he makes and what support he gets.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, it's probably when they were going well, like, you know, the odd sort of cameo moment by Origi or even like, you know, a Shaqiri or Oxlade-Chamberlain would be pointed to as a strength. You know, they had a really good, strong, reliable core, but they could turn to these lads. But then all of a sudden, you know, when they're struggling a bit, these become weaknesses. And you look at what City are doing. We talked about them earlier, where, you know, they can have maybe someone like Sterling maybe having a below par season, maybe by his standard, yet it's grand. They don't need him. Like, whereas Liverpool, like, they couldn't, I don't know what the equivalent player is, but, you know, Liverpool couldn't really afford to sort of sit, you know, Firmino or Mane, for all their bad record, they couldn't afford to leave them out for, like, you know, 4 or 5 games. They don't really have the option to do that. I saw obviously some of the commentary and been pointed out during the week that, you know, Stephen referenced them there, like, after signing Thiago and making a big play about signing him, that ultimately for the 2 games against Madrid, he wasn't trusted to start either of them, and they felt the other day that they needed, okay, a different type of player, you know, and Henderson is out, so they felt they needed what Milner brings to it, which maybe points to that text there about, you know, that they're missing that degree of seniority. But like, Milner is what, 35 now, maybe, you know, 34 35, and when you have that and you still have this, you know, this sort of back chat about Salah and what's happening with his advisors and his people and the frequency of, like, interviews he's doing in Spain and stuff, like, it sort of feels like they need more work than you might imagine, the squad. You know, it's not necessarily just like touching up, and listen, I'm sure Van Dijk coming back will suddenly provide a degree of reassurance that will maybe remove some fears, but it sort of does feel like it's not just that they lack players in the squad, but like some of the ones that they're leaning on are coming towards the end of a cycle naturally too. So they've won a lot of praise for the business of their recruitment, you know, the bottom line, you know, the net spend, you know, relative to, you know, what they've sold and all this. But there possibly comes a point where they just have to, like, splash out big time, and which they have done in recent seasons for individual players. But maybe they really need to maybe bring in quite a number of players, which is surprising. But clearly, I mean, we've said this a number of times across the year, I think, that they operated at such a high standard for a couple of seasons, that maybe it's just all caught up with them. And once they've lost, you know, they had a relentless run of things and these long sequences and runs, and maybe it just needs that bit of refreshing that happens when, you know, these cycles, a little mini cycle of that group runs its course. Maybe a big personality needs to leave, you know. It's sort of
Salah.
You know, well, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like a mad thing to say when he's probably still been their best player. But like sometimes, like, you know, Ferguson always used to like regenerate his team. He wasn't afraid to let a big personality go, you know, in terms of like the evolution of Ferguson's time. Like there was several different Uniteds during that period, and sometimes big players going was a part of that. And maybe it's not Salah, but I'm just saying maybe that's
not,
part of
it. Take that as well. Obviously, it's been the same for everybody, but I think the lack of crowd as well, I think it's affected Liverpool more, because I think the Liverpool, especially at Anfield, I think the home crowd creates a little bit more atmosphere there for Liverpool, that the team and Klopp kind of reacted. Because
I take the point though. But is there too many bad results for that to be an excuse now?
My point being, I'm saying it's not the only reason. But even when they played Madrid, at the little training ground stadium, I forget the name of it.
Yeah.
This Stefano, Klopp even mentioned that. He goes, oh, we get them back at Anfield where it's a proper stadium. So obviously that's in Klopp's head, that he kind of, his presence on the line, like he's a little bit different than, say, the likes of a Thomas Tuchel or a Pep Guardiola. He's a little bit more animated and the crowd react to him a little bit more of his kind of the way he carries himself on the line. That's all part and parcel of his management style. And I think the fact that he hasn't had that crowd there hasn't helped him more than maybe other clubs. But again, you can't use these as excuses, but because every other club has kind of had the same problem. But I do think it's affected Liverpool a little bit more. And the fact that he remarked about that, the Madrid playing the game at that stadium and how they'd be back at a proper ground, tells me that it plays on his mind maybe more than other managers.
Liverpool fans, 53106, so who would you be happy to see leave Anfield in the summer, and who would you like to get into the club? Because I think there probably do need to be some changes at Liverpool. A good narrative, Stephen, about Unai Emery and Mikel Arteta meeting. This will be a good barometer of where Arteta is in the Arsenal Villarreal Europa League semi-final.
Yeah, it's a big game for Arsenal. Again, league form for Arsenal. You watch them sometimes and you come away and I think I was on before, when you're watching Arsenal now sometimes in the league, it's boring to watch them, whereas under Wenger, especially for a time, they're probably the most exciting team to watch, keeping the ball, passing the ball, and you look forward to watching them, whereas at the moment, more often than not, you'd watch an Arsenal game and you'd probably flicker off and see if there's another game on. But the fact is that they've got themselves now into the semi-final of the Europa League against Villarreal, another good team with the manager that's been there before, which kind of adds a little bit more kind of to the tie. But I watched the Arsenal game actually on Thursday against Prague, and I thought Arsenal were really, really good. It's the best I've seen them play in a long time. They looked like they knew what they were about. They attacked quick and they had urgency in the game, and that's something that you don't always see with Arsenal recent times. They kind of tend to just kind of drift through games, passy, and kind of fluffy football where they're not really getting anywhere. But I thought on Thursday night they knew they needed to kind of make a statement, and they did. And Prague couldn't live with them, and it sets them up for a potential. Well, they could potentially get to the final of that and play against Man United, which would be cracking from an English football point of view. But no, yeah, it's a good tie, and I think they've have history as well, Villarreal and Arsenal. So it's a big test, and obviously the manager going back to his old club will be interesting to see how he sets up against them.
53106, lads, why are you giving Liverpool so much airtime on FA Cup semi-final day and speak about the City and the Chelsea, says Andrew in Cork. Well, we did speak about City and Chelsea earlier on in the show. It is a two-hour show, Andrew, and you'll be able to hear the podcast back, although I suppose by the time it'll be a little bit for that issue, it'll be a little bit time sensitive with the Chelsea City game kicking off at 5:30. I thought they won it, Dan, when Lacazette made that excellent gesture before the game. I thought Arsenal won the game right there and then. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but that's the way I saw it.
I think they won it when they steamrolled them. But I know the point you're making. Like it's the image that people will take away from the game. But I mean, powerful gestures aren't always followed by wins. But like I suppose, yeah, like you know, I can imagine it's been a turbulent time in Prague. You know, like I you know, you sort of lose a big player, you know, a big ban, a lot of scrutiny on the club and focus. Although, you know, I think the perception of that issue probably locally in the Czech Republic might be slightly different than what it might be in this part of the world. But that's a slightly by the by. Like, do they feel even a sense of injustice, you'd wonder? But it was a big statement for him to do it. And I mean, I don't know, you can read too much into these meetings, but I suppose, yeah, do the teammates look at it, and does it sort of, do you draw some strength from it? I mean, his individual performance itself, the fact that he backed it up himself was pretty impressive. But it was, I mean, that was obviously the story that the sort of, that you know, hung over the week, you know, and hung over the game. And it's obviously, you know, there's a debate around whether the stance and the ban that was given out was strong enough, you know, and what sort of message it will send going forward, you know. And clearly, you know, you kind of wonder, is this a point in the sand in terms of, you know, stronger sanctions for instances of racism? You know, I appreciate some people think, you know, 10 games might be soft, but actually it's still stronger than some of what we've seen before, you know, in terms of a real sort of strong statement. And hopefully that will be something from this week that, you know, that will be the bare minimum in a way going forward for something like this.
United winning against Granada was much easier, Stephen, in ways over the two legs, because it was pretty much wrapped up. It was interesting. I know Pogba had that crack at Mourinho yesterday, but what was more interesting to me is that he was praising Solskjaer. Maybe the options for Pogba to leave and find a suitable suitor might be a little bit less than they were.
Yeah, it's, again, we spoke briefly about earlier on the Pogba-Mourinho one. It's just a strange one. It's obviously there's a bit of bad blood there between the pair of them, and the fact that Mourinho says he wasn't bothered, and again, it's a bit, I think it's just a little bit of pantomime stuff. But Pogba himself, like, yeah, he's come out and he's back Solskjaer. And listen, I think Solskjaer is popular with the players. There's no doubt about that. You listen to the players speak, and they all seem to speak highly of him. And I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is a likable person. I don't think he's the kind of most offensive of guys. Like, you wouldn't be looking at him going, oh, he kind of just gets on with his job. Again, I think he's a little bit lucky to find himself as manager of Man United, but he's done all right. He hasn't been perfect, but I think Man United are improving at the moment. And again, if he can come out of this season finishing second place, it's looking like they're going to finish second in the Premier League and a good chance of winning a European competition, then people are going to pat him on the back. And I think, considering some of the criticism he took earlier on in the season, I think you'd have to give him kind of big credit. And he's kind of showed a great resilience to kind of keep going and kind of keep coming out and speaking in front of, because he did. I remember it went through a stage where he was getting a lot of criticism about how his team was playing and not knowing what formation and what was asked of him. But he's found a way. And again, you can point to the players Man United have at their disposal, like attacking players. They can, on the day, if they turn around, they can kind of do it against anybody. But the fact that, I don't know, I just think Cavani makes a difference when he plays for them as well. I think even watching him there when he was trying to kind of on-field coaching of Greenwood there last week, I thought that was brilliant. Like, kind of just showing him how he kind of getting him to get his head up, explaining that he's making his move early. And these are all things that will help players around Man United. And I don't know how strong that deal is for Cavani to kind of go back to South America in the summer, because you're looking at him now, he looks fitter than anybody. I would be inclined to try and keep him at Man United if possible.
Stephen, you're the striker here. You're the ex-striker here. Everyone raves about his movement. I mean, is that Cavani, that is? Like, can you see it? And can that be taught, or is that natural, if you know what I mean? Some of those instincts.
Now listen, I see Cavani, the style of player Cavani is, I love watching him play, because he's what you describe as an old school forward as well. He works hard, he's a pest for defenders. He runs into the positions where, like, you know, sometimes you look at forwards, you want to come short and defenders can see them playing, like they play in front of defenders. And listen, you can get some great players that can drop into the hole, pick up the ball and get torn and run at defenders, like, and you can't stop them. But Cavani does everything. He runs behind, he runs balls that aren't meant to be for him. He makes them difficult for defenders, and he's just a pest to play against. And obviously, again, he's got immense quality footballs in the box, as you see over the past few weeks. He can score a goal, and his movements, he kind of goes short to go far, he goes far to go short, and he's constantly on the move, and he's constantly giving information out to players around him where he wants them to move, and he points as well where he wants other players to go. And again, you always hear that saying, if any young strikers are out there watching forwards, keep your eye on Cavani. But again, he's the perfect, for me, he's one of my favourite players to watch in the Premier League, because he's just, he never, even if things, like, you never watch him and say he's having a bad game. He's always involved. He's always trying to kind of get himself in the line of the ball so he can give his teammates an option. And I genuinely think that the young lads at Man United would have learned a terrible lot off him over the last season, I'd imagine. And I think Solskjaer, that was a great little signing Solskjaer made at a time where United were struggling up there.
This is interesting because our own Arthur James OD has written a very interesting long-form piece on otbsports.com today about Ruud van Nistelrooy. Well worth a read. He has spoken to Ramon Calderon, Martin Reusser, Kenny Cunningham, Fapa Dahan and Paul McShane about the Dutchman. Ruud van Nistelrooy, prolific goal scorer for Manchester United, 150 goals in 219 games for the Red Devils. Did you ever encounter Ruud van Nistelrooy in your playing career, Stephen?
Yeah, I played against him when he was at Man United. It was a bit like Cavani. Ruud was immense. It was an immense player, I think, and the Premier League. And if you remember, I think when he first was due to come into the Premier League, he'd done his cruciate, and the move was put back a year, wasn't it? And you're thinking, well, maybe he's missed the boat, but he kind of got himself back after his injury, and he came to Man United, and for a few seasons he was phenomenal, wasn't he? And if you watch all his goals, all his goals came from inside the box. I remember actually when I was at Preston North End, and our manager at the time, Alan Irvin, used to say to us, to the forwards, there was myself, John Park, and Chris Brown, and Neil Miller, who, you know, we would have been the four strikers at the football club at the time. And again, we were going through a patch where we weren't scoring many goals. And I always remember Alan Irvine said to me, he says, go and watch that. He took us into the video room with the video analysis, and he put a kind of Ruud van Nistelrooy montage on. He says, watch him, watch his movement in the box and get yourself in them positions. And he made us watch them and just learn from him. And even at that level when we were playing, like Alan Irvine, like even at that age, I don't know what age I would have been at that stage, mid-20s, similar to the other lads. And we were sitting there watching Ruud van Nistelrooy's movement, trying to learn from him even to score some goals. Right enough, I didn't score many goals after watching it, but a few of the other lads did. But now he was a phenomenal forward. And again, we're talking about a player playing in a world-class team, winning the Premier Leagues. And a thing as well, you listen to ex-Man United players speak about Ruud van Nistelrooy when he played. Remember, I would have been in Roy Keane's presence. I don't know where or when I was, but I know I remember he was speaking to us about Ruud van Nistelrooy, saying how good he was and that he was just an absolute machine. Like, just his whole mindset was score goals, and that was all that he was bothered about, just scoring goals. And you could see it in the way he played. And again, there's not many strikers out there at the moment, like out and out strikers like him in the game anymore.
I read Arthur's piece, John.
Oh, very good, yeah.
And it's sort of striking. I mean, by the way, it's a weird guest list of people that he spoke to there. It's like a Big Brother house selection or something. You could pop them all in there. It's a diverse list of characters. But like that whole point that, you know, that struck you is like how he was 100%. Like sort of selfish in a way. Like, you know, he wouldn't enjoy the game if he didn't score. And there's obviously, like, I suppose, and like, I don't know, Stephen, like, you know, can strikers sometimes become too unselfish that they lose that you probably sometimes need to have that streak in you, maybe. Like, and obviously you come out and do an interview and say, of course, the main thing is the team won today, and I'm very happy the team won. But you sense that Van Nistelrooy really drove him, you know, it drove him mad if he didn't. And like some players probably just need to have that streak in them. That's certain selfishness, but it does actually help the team as well. But it's sort of their single-minded focus.
Yeah, I think Ruud, like the way he played, I remember even at the time, because I would have watched him closely, you'd listen to him and listen to people, even John O'Shea speaking about him, and he'd say he wouldn't be happy if he didn't score, even if the team won 3 or 4-0. If he didn't score, he'd be fuming after the game. Now, again, I played up front, but when I played, like, I don't think I had that kind of, I don't think I ever felt that way myself personally, because I would have played up front, but I also played on the right wing and the left wing as well. So I played in different positions. So although I was a forward, I used to, as long as I was in the team, because as a forward, especially at the teams I was at, there was always four strikers there. And you always were in a rotation, or you'd play two, and then maybe you play for four or five games, then the other two. Because I was never part in a team where a forward was as prolific, say, as a Ruud van Nistelrooy was, so he automatically played. So there was always rotations, but because I was kind of versatile enough where I could play on either kind of flank and kind of do a job there, like, so to speak, then I could probably, that as I got a bit older in my career, that kind of goal scoring kind of mentality in my mind went out a little bit, where I was more kind of worried about getting in the team and playing. Like, and again, it all depends as well on the style of team play. I remember when I was at Hearts, I would have played up front on my own, but my job in the team, obviously my second season there, I didn't score as many goals as I would have liked, but the manager used to say to me, Paulo Sergio, Portuguese lad, says, listen, you're not there to score goals, but if you score, great, because my job in the team was just to run and be a pest to create space for the likes of Rudy Scatchell and other players who would have, like Rudy, I think, scored 16 or 17 that year, but basically he never ran in the game. He used to just kind of sit in that, just off me. And I'm not saying, like, I'm not saying that I'm making excuses for the goal, but sometimes you set up in a way that's why managers are there, to set up the teams up to try and get results. But I think Ruud, I don't think Ruud, you could ever set the Ruud van Nistelrooy, listen, you're playing, I don't want you to be not in the box, because if you watch him, his whole game kind of orientated around the box. If he came outside the box to feed the ball, his first thought would be, I'm going to get the box. But he had, let's be honest, he had some decent crosses putting balls in the box for him, didn't he, as well at Man United. Probably helped his cause, but no, he was a fantastic striker, Ruud, probably the best of his era, I think, in the Premier League. Obviously, Thierry Henry would have been around that time, but I think he was a different player to Henry. He was more of an out-and-out forward, whereas Thierry Henry could pick the ball up in his own box and run by the whole team and score a goal, whereas I think I only remember Ruud van Nistelrooy doing that once in one game. He picked the ball up in the halfway line. I think it was Fulham at home. Remember, he picked her up and scored. But other than that, I can't remember Ruud scoring many goals where they weren't kind of crosses into the box or like picking, like passing into him in and around the 6-yard area. And it was a bit like Harry Kane. I think, like, he, more often than not, his goals were very similar to the way Harry Kane scores his goals in that 6-yard box.
5-3-1-6 Manchester United fans, your fondness, your memories of Ruud van Nistelrooy, get in touch with us. If you want to check out the piece, and you should, otbsports.com, Arthur O'Dea's piece on Ruud van Nistelrooy, who was born on the same day as Patrick Kluivert. I always found that a strange stat, the two players that end up going and playing alongside each other with the Netherlands. We're going to take a break. We're going to talk about the League of Ireland and football jerseys after this. It's 5-3-1-0-6 is the number to get in touch on OTB Football Saturday with Stephen Elliott and Dan McDonald. Don't go away.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
Andrew, welcome back to OTB Football Saturday with John Duggan with you through until 5 o'clock in the company of the former Republic of Ireland striker Stephen Elliott and the Irish Independent football correspondent Dan McDonnell. Just was an interesting exchange during the week about Nathan Murphy with Joe Malloy and Will O'Callaghan discussing about his football mad son who wants to get an English football jersey.
Have I just broken my ankle trying to do a rainbow flick? Yeah, I probably have. So I have a football mad 7-year-old. His birthday is coming up. For every birthday, he wants a jersey. So his birthday is in May, which is an awkward time because the jerseys are pretty much out of date. So I said, why don't you get yourself a jersey ahead of the Euros? So he said, absolutely, I would love to get a jersey ahead of the Euros. Ah. I want an England jersey. Oof. And he is now nailed on getting an England jersey. I'm wondering, is it worth the hassle? I don't really have an issue with this. I'm struggling to explain to him. I obviously went with the 800 years of oppression and all that. He made the point, what's got to do with Jack Grealish? Which I said, well, that's another complication that you may have here. So I don't actually have a problem with him getting the England jersey. He loves English football. He's obsessed with the Premier League. He watches these guys every week. All the players he likes play for England pretty much. And I'm like, are you going to be walking down the street and someone's just going to be giving you a bit of hassle about it? Have we moved on as a nation? Are we okay with kids wearing England jerseys?
What's your sense?
I'm okay with it, so I think I'm going to let him at it. I may put him off the Grealish on the back.
Well, that's just trolling.
Certainly the Rice 4 on the back. Keep it simple. Go with Harry Kane. Pretty inoffensive for everybody, surely.
I think it's fine. I think in our generation it would have been big trouble.
Yeah, I think if you were wandering down for a kick around the park, you'd be getting kicked a lot.
Yeah.
But surely in this day and age we've moved on.
Surely there's no issue with that. We all support English players every week for English clubs like Harry Kane. I support Spurs and Jordan Henderson, some many Liverpool fans. Of course, we're Ireland fans, but I don't think there's any issue with what Nathan's son would want. But Stephen Elliott, have you ever regretted getting a jersey?
No, I don't think so. Like, but going back to the England one, I wouldn't get my kid in England straight. And they're, like, honestly, this is true stuff. All my kids are kind of half English as well, because my wife's from Sunderland. But I remember, I think years back, one of my wife's sisters bought one of the kids in England strip, and I says, that's not coming into my house. I wouldn't let me little fellow wear it. Like, and it's, listen, I know, listen, you can, we've moved on from that, but there's like moving on from that, and then there's watching somebody walk around your house in an England strip. I'm not having that, like, no chance.
Dan, have you anything to add to that?
Listen, obviously, like, our country's relationship with football is obviously, you know, warped in its own way. And, like, I understand, like, Nathan's point. I mean, you know, people can wear any Premier League club, you know, shirt. And yeah, it's, you can see why. Well, it's not that much of a big deal, really, is it, to wear England? Well, I understand that argument. But I don't know. There's still something about the England shirt, isn't there? You know, you can still, now, in fairness, you would get that with some of the certain clubs, like, you know, Chelsea away and stuff. In fairness, as much as my Chelsea supporting mates will get on to me, but like some of the chants and stuff. But like, I mean, to be fair, like the England games, they've had an issue in recent years with some, you know, chants of Irish related stuff at games. Oh, it's mainly IRA related stuff. Okay, so we're going in a bit of a different road. But I mean, there's still a part of us that will remember. Like you still think of like, you know, the English fans in 95 and stuff. And we have to move beyond that. We have to be bigger than that. We have to be better than that. I know. We completely have to be all of those things. But do you want your child wearing an England shirt? Like, I don't think there's anything wrong in saying you don't want it. No. I don't think, like, that's the nature of rivalry or whatever it is.
See, this, Dan, right? I remember, see, watching the last World Cup, right? I actually had a big argument with my wife. Because, like, we're watching England in the World Cup. My little fella who loves football, we're watching the match together, and he's running around the house when Croatia scored, screaming. And she's like, do you know what I mean? And it kind of, she blamed me on it, but I wasn't. I was just sitting quite calm. But obviously, he just got excited himself because Croatia scored, because he's obviously in school with all his mates, and they're all giving him having a bit of Irish, like, friendly banter. But he's screaming. I'm like, listen, I'm like, that, Joey, calm down, will you? I don't want your ma hearing this because I'll get it in the neck.
Listen, I think sometimes we want to be seen to be, of course, we're bigger than that and moving on beyond, and that's everyone's individual opinion, but like, it wouldn't
you
be for
telling
me, but
there's many Irishmen out there of England are in the World Cup final, you'd be cheering England on.
They do exist. They wouldn't be me now, I have to admit. Yeah, but yeah, they are out there. I mean, John, you've stayed very quiet there for a minute, John. World Cup 2018, you were getting on the English Express, were you?
I wanted England to reach the final so they could get hammered by France 4-1 in the final. I was supporting England against Croatia because it would be hypocritical of me to be supporting Harry Kane and Kieran Trippier and Dele Alli every single week and chanting for them and not wishing England well against Croatia. They'd never been in a World Cup semi-final since 1990.
You don't have to live in England, I suppose, John, do you?
No, I don't, no.
And but isn't there a debate here? Do you associate a team with its players or do you associate it with, like, you know, the organization again it represents? It almost goes back to the sports washing stuff earlier. Like, can you separate the players from the, you know, from the flag or the crest or whatever? But I mean, I have to say, like, I've been to the last couple of major tournaments and, you know, most of the English fans are there, absolutely no problem. But obviously there is like an element there that you're thinking, yeah, I'm not really mad on their team potentially winning this tournament, to be honest. And listen, maybe that's not. Maybe we're being small-minded by thinking that.
There's a lot of England fans out there that cheer on Ireland, and
I know, yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, well, I just can't repay the favour. I don't know why.
But this is our sort of post-colonial complex or something. This is what happens, you know.
And the reason why I was staying quiet is because the texts are coming in, as you would expect, on 53106. Love it from Stephen Elliott. Brilliant. Couldn't agree more, says Theo in Dublin. The hypocrisy of Irish football fans follow English clubs but at the same time have a problem with the England team. What about a Rangers jersey, says another of our texters. And lads, as a former designer who worked with the Irish kid for Italia 90 when they had a plant here in Cork, what's the difference between an Irish kid wearing the English national team top as opposed to a Premiership top, says Andy. But I think it might be to what Dan just said there, and national teams and national identity versus club players. his madness, his goals in the comeback against Villa in the Cup in 01 and 02 and the madness that followed. Ruud van Nistelrooy, tra-la-la-la-la. Singing that song to myself now because of the memory, says Dweeds from Dublin. And John Duggan says, it's strange that Clivers and van Nistelrooy were born on the same day. I can top that. Thierry Henry and William Gallas were both born on the same day, August the 17th, 1977, with Henry's famous handball, or infamous, setting up Gallas for the goal to beat Ireland back in 2009, says James in Cork. There you go.
God, yeah. Bring up the Henry goal now, just to get us really going on the patriotism at this stage. Yeah,
we only got 15 minutes left, yeah.
Yeah, we can't go for England now, actually, no. Sorry, no. It's not allowed.
The team's in for Chelsea against City in the Cup semi-final at Wembley at 5:30. For Chelsea, Kepa, Aspilicueta, Thiago, Rudiger, James, Jorginho, Conte, Chilwell, Ziyech, Werner and Mount. So Havertz on the bench for Chelsea. For City, Stefan, who gets his nod in goal, as he should, with Guardiola professing to continue with that policy. Cancelo, Diaz, Laporte, Mendy, Rodri, Fernandinho, De Bruyne, Torres, Sterling, who gets his chance today, and Gabriel Jesus. So no Foden in the City 11 for that game, which kicks off at 5:30. Daniel, in terms of fans for the League of Ireland, when are we hoping to get some supporters back? Is there any kind of news on that?
It's hard to know. I mean, obviously, there's this sort of the antigen testing story this week about Leinster and what they're planning to do. And, you know, there had been suggestions maybe there might be League of Ireland versions of that. But obviously, there's a... You know, there's, when you're talking about a very limited percentage of capacity, then the sort of the modest nature of some of the stadiums, like, it makes it slightly more difficult, you know. And this is my personal view, it's not information, but I would have thought if you're going to do something like that in the League of Ireland, you'd be looking at a game in Talla, Turner's Cross, even though they're in the First Division, maybe even Sligo, you know, there's Waterford. There's a couple of places that would be sort of, you know, you would think the layout would be such you could maybe try something and some of the sort of better facilities, because this is the problem that we have, unfortunately, with the league, that not all the grounds are, you know, they're not very health and safety conscious as it is, you know, before sort of COVID and what that demands of them. But it is badly needed, there's no doubt. I mean, we spoke earlier about, you know, Stephen mentioned how, you know, watching Blackpool Sunderland is sort of tough going, you know, relative to the Champions League, and it's, I'm very, very, you know, passionate League of Ireland person, and you know, big fan, and I'll be watching games tonight. You know, I'm looking forward to probably watching, I'm not at one, but I'll be probably watching Dundalk Pats, more likely watching that than Chelsea City. But it can be harder going sometimes, but you really miss the atmosphere and the sort of the spark and the tension and stuff. Like I watched Waterford Bows yesterday, you know, 5:45 game. You know, not under lights, no fans, and it sort of just petered out a bit in the end. And that is obviously just one of the things that we badly need it. You know, we badly need supporters back in stadiums or in all sports and all codes. And it's something that we should be working towards, definitely. I still don't, you know, you get the sense that it's at times there's been discussion about fans reporting, you know, returning to stadiums. That's been down the list almost at the same level as, like, you know, festivals and full indoor pubs and stuff, when we know that outdoor, you know, outdoor gatherings really shouldn't be perceived. And I understand it's to do with congregation and people traveling together and that type of thing. But it's definitely something they have to be looking at proactively, I think, at this stage, both financially, but even just for everyone's, I think, well-being, to be honest. Because a lot of people, you know, they're missing a routine from their life they used to have.
Yeah, 5:30, 6:00. Lads, surely no one would hurt abuse at a seven-year-old in an England jersey. I think most rational adults would instinctively know the child follows English football and probably worships some of their players. It's the adults that have the issue, says Mim in Cork, or, on one of our texters on 5:30, 6:00. Graham Burke's goal for Rovers the other night was sensational from the halfway line. The League of Ireland seems to have a lot of that. Puskas Awards stop goals, and Conan Byrne did it a few years ago.
I have a funny feeling Stephen's going to come in now and talk about the goalkeeper for that goal, right? But I thought it was, like, technically brilliant. But the one thing I would say, the reason that the League of Ireland does have a lot of good goals is because, I mean, put simply, there's a lot of very good technical players in it. Look, there's actually, spoke about this with Stewie Byrne the other night, there's probably a higher concentration of technical players now in the league that maybe you talk to lads who played in it years ago, they would say it was a bit more physical and a bit more... you know, wouldn't be a place for a young player, whereas now it's a lot of young players, a lot of talented, ex-academy players in England and stuff who maybe certain things haven't worked out for him at various times, but there's a lot of like really creative players in the league. So it doesn't surprise me that there's excellent goals scored. But come on, give us your goalkeeper, Thierry, Stephen. You're not... You weren't mad at the keeper.
We discussed this off air, John, and he was just saying, what do you think? And obviously, like Dan says, there is some really, really good technical players in the league. But I think the reason why there's a lot of good goals scored, I think it's obviously goalkeeper position as well. And I think, I'm not calling out all the goalkeepers that play in the League of Ireland, but I just don't think the goalkeepers are that great in the league in general, in my opinion. And I'll back her up by saying, for example, in recent times, like, obviously Brian Murphy there, who in the League of Ireland was probably one of the best keepers, if not the best keeper in the league for a long time before he got his move to the UK at that time. And when he was playing in the UK at big clubs, he hardly kicked the ball. He played very little for all these clubs he was at. So my point is, now I know I'm only judging off one keeper, but the fact is that somebody that was so... And I played with Murphy at City in the academy. Great keeper, you know what I mean? Assisting me with so many goals in the U team, like lashing balls over the top of defenders from me going back years here. But I just think in general, the goalkeepers aren't that great in comparison to other leagues. And I think maybe that has something to do with some of the goals that are going in. And as I said, Brian was probably one of the best keepers in the league, yet when he went and played at a higher level, he hardly really got a look in. So maybe that tells you a little bit. That's just my opinion.
But it was a hell of a strike, though. In fairness,
to Brian, Fantastic.
Which is interesting because we have, at the moment in Ireland, we've got keepers coming through like Kelleher and Bazunu.
Yeah, and Bazunu played in the league here and was like very, very good. You could see it. He was at 16. Yeah, he was 16 and he was well able to... Brian Murphy, we're running out of time here, but like Brian Murphy, by the way, not playing for Waterford, and there's something, there's sort of a... strange goings on there behind the scenes, it would appear, at Waterford, and his position is up for debate, which isn't good for them at all. Waterford are struggling with Kevin Sheedy, but there's definitely something in recent seasons that, I mean, Alan Manis, Gary Rogers, who retired, Brian Murphy coming back, that the better goalkeepers in the league, you know, Brendan Clark as well, would all be sort of in their sort of, you know, late 30s, you know, and Mark McNulty even still doing it, that maybe... But maybe that might be changing generationally, as you mentioned. Like, there's a good underage crop, and in fairness, there are some younger keepers knocking on the door around the league. So maybe the next generation of keepers will be better than the one that's in their prime now, in their mid-20s, late-20s. We didn't have a great generation of them there, perhaps.
We have a couple of minutes left, Dan. What's your early takeaways from the season so far?
From the league season?
Yeah, apart from Dundalk, obviously spoke about earlier.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Dundalk one is just carnage, you know. But that's not... I mean, we did probably say that was a possibility, and unfortunately that has come to pass. I think the main thing is that Shamrock Rovers have the best squad. I think Stephen probably agrees with me in that. They look like the strongest team. But the good thing for me is that St. Patrick's Athletic look better this year. I think Sligo Rovers look better this year. And then hopefully we might have a bit more depth in that sort of... We've had a lot of two-horse races in recent seasons and the rest nowhere. And then hopefully we're having a slight improvement at the higher end in terms of a little bit more strength and depth, and so that Shamrock Rovers will be challenged more consistently. Because my criticism of the league in recent seasons is that we've had some very good sides, but it's too easy for them some weeks. And like that's been the problem. And even Shamrock Rovers, they've drawn against both those teams I mentioned. They've dropped points against them. Because ultimately, when it gets around to Europe in the summer, we want our clubs to do well. And I think sometimes the problem is that they're undercooked, our better sides, because they're not being tested regularly enough week on week. So I hope that some of the sides, you know, and that are hoping to get up and push up and get better are getting better. You know, so I think St. Pat's and Sligo Rovers for me. I know Stephen's watched a bit of Sligo Rovers because I think he's a bit of a family link there. But they're getting a bit better, hopefully, and that would be better for the league in general.
Okay, Dan McDonald, Stephen Elliott, enjoy the sun, lads, and thanks so much for this afternoon.
Cheers, John.
Thanks, lads.
OTB Football Saturday, Stephen Elliott and Dan McDonald, as always, great stuff.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.